Hello and welcome back to the Soapbox podcast for a little discussion around day two of the Intergenerate Conference and all the highlights and probably the best learnings that my dad Darren has taken from today. How are you going? I know you've been out in the city. Tell us what you've been doing in Nashville today.
Yes, so we had a full day of presentations, workshops and Taste and See, which is looking at ministry models today. So went from 7:30 a.m. right through till 6:30 p.m. So then a few of us from Australia jumped in a couple of cars and went into the Nashville City, which is the country western capital of the USA, more or less. And we walked up and down the streets, which is full of bands playing, buskers, country and western just everywhere. And every bar was full of people, and often there was three levels in the bars, and a band, separate band, a country western band, drummer, couple guitarists, violin, singers on every level. So it's just mind-blowing. And I asked a couple of the bouncers as to do the bands get paid, and they do get a flat rate, normally about $100 per person, but then they rely on tips and everybody putting tips into buckets. So they had big buckets in front of them that they were taking cash. And that's the American society, where a lot of the society actually exists on tipping. And that's where the people make their money from.
Interesting. It's a love to go there one day and look at the city, but it's not just a city. Tell us about Intergenerate today. What was really the things that you experienced today in that Taste and See, or that experience of intergenerational worship in Intergenerate today?
Yes, well, I guess the theme, and I guess one of my interests across the whole of the day, and some of that I had to go to because I was facilitating some of the workshops, and so that when I went where I was told to go to host and make sure the workshop happened, but I'm glad I went. And the theme, I think, of today was the spirituality and the intergenerationality of play. And I think sometimes we don't do enough playing. And that was a theme. Mimi Larson, who's one of my good friends, and she's a lecturer and a theologian, written a lot of around this subject and research on this subject. She was telling me, here's an idea. What if every church had a playground outside, but not just the playground? The playground is a church, if you like, a play church. So it's built in the shape of a church. It would have a pulpit, it would have seats in it, it would have guitar, musical instruments, it would have bits and pieces that the kids after church go and play church, because play is how they assimilate and understand and make sense of what they've experienced in worship. And so I was pretty blown away with that idea. Apparently some of the men in the church got together and made this model church out in the kids' playground, and that's where the kids go and play after church. And
I love it.
And yes, yeah.
So I mean, my church is half the way there. They have a playground outside for the kids to play on, and there's handball courts and there's all those things. But I love the idea of creating a space where the kids can mimic in many ways and learn what the adults are doing. And it kind of reminds me, I don't know if you saw it online, but there was a guy who made an using artificial intelligence photos of toddlers doing church as a full toddlers conference. And I thought, that's such an interesting concept, but that's really come out to play in what Mimi was sharing, in enabling kids to copy and to learn what their parents are doing. That's so cool.
Yes. And a lot of what she, like Mimi did a workshop on intergenerationality and worship and why we need to include kids in worship. And a lot of her theory is based on John Westerhoff, which is one of the forefathers, if you like, of the children's ministry movement. His book, Will Children Have Faith, is a classic, and you can find it anywhere. I've got a copy that I found secondhand on, but you can find a copy of that one, Will Our Children Have Faith. It really is and he was discussing, it really is the Bible, if you like, in some ways, of children's ministries. And he was discussing the idea of children and all of us grow spiritually when we rub shoulders together. So he was discussing the intergenerational connections right back then when he wrote. So I think that'll be the overall theme today. Daryl Hall started the day, Daryl Lee Hall, who is a pastor in Georgia, and he wrote a book called Speaking Across Generations, Messages That Satisfy Boomers, Xers, Millennials, Gen Z and Beyond. And his basic premise of his presentation was that every generation engages the same word through unique sensibilities. And encourage us to, when we preach, to speak the language that each generation needs to hear. And that's, he uses 1 Corinthians 9, 19, 23, where Paul says that he becomes a Jew to reach a Jew, he becomes a Gentile to reach a Gentile, he becomes under the law to reach those under the law, and he becomes above the law, those above the law, in order to reach some and win some for the gospel. And so he said, really, today we are being missionaries across generations in learning how to preach and reach those in different generational groups. In having a chat with Steve Case after that, we agree that sometimes you can make those generational divides too much of a thing. And in some ways, the generational divides have been devised by marketers so that there's niche marketing to various generations. So you got to be careful to not pigeonhole people and to realise that some people might what you call a millennial, but they really think like a Gen Xer or a baby boomer or whatever. So you've got to be careful to pigeonhole age groups and age brackets as well. So that's a bit of a caution there. But at the same time, I think we need to think about from the oldest to the youngest in our pews, how are we preaching and reaching each person that comes into worship?
I love it. And I think intergenerational ministry has been really the theme of my day, actually, because I've been, it's all me and my associate pastor, that's what we spoke about for the hour that we were together, and how can we connect the generations together. And I love the reflections that you and Dr. Steve had there about the fact that we have perhaps made the generations too big of a highlight, because we notice that we struggle, and this isn't just for the church I'm currently, this is a across the church thing, we struggle to get the elderly or the older people or the senior people, the people in actually the prime of their life, to be honest, to see the benefit from mentoring and from connecting with those that are younger. And
yeah,
how do we make those connections happen? Because that's how church really becomes church, is when the older people are connecting to the younger people and vice versa. That's when we see play. That's when we see joy. That's when we see all of those things start to flourish in our churches. And one of the struggles that we have noticed is that many senior people are happy to give their money.
Mm-hmm.
They're happy to give all of those things, but they're not happy to give their time.
And that's been exacerbated since COVID in some ways, mm-hmm, as well. It's interesting. It's the hardest decision to fill of those that involve working with children or those with the younger generations. People say, oh, I did my time, I've done that, I can now sit in the pew and I'll pay money for it, but don't ask me to actually volunteer and do anything.
Yeah, and I think that's, I don't know if that's something that's going to really get nutted out at your conference at the moment, but I think that's something that is perhaps the biggest challenge I'm hearing to make intergenerational ministry practical, is how do we convince those that we need to get involved to invest their time to our young people? Because that's what love is spelt like. Love is spelt T-I-M-E for young people, rather than being willing to give money to make events or make programs happen. Because intergenerational ministry or intergenerational church isn't a program. It's changing the ethos of what we do at church.
It is, it is. And how far you go with that is the issue. And that's where David Sinos's talk, and David Sinos is a really good personal friend of mine. He's coming out to Australia. He advertised yesterday. We'll get some advertising attached for registration. If you are listening and really want to understand intergenerational preaching, he's written a book just called called A Gospel for All Ages, Teaching and Preaching with the Whole Church. And I have my copy here, which David has quite happily signed. And he says in the front, for Darren, a lifelong learner, a soapbox stander, and an ardent intergen ally with gratitude, David Sinos. And, yes, he's coming out and he's going to tour around most states. Sorry, Western Australia, you're not quite getting over there. But we are going to Tasmania this year, and we're doing Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane, and we're going to New Zealand, doing Auckland and Christchurch, and, of course, don't forget Hobart. So he's going to be touring around, and there are also workshops at each venue as well from local practitioners to really discuss the preaching event and how to make preaching intergenerational. David Sinos calls it the last frontier. Often we can muck around everything else and say, yes, we're intergenerational, but the pastor, whether it's because the pastor loves their power or it's the way they're trained, they really want to hold on to the actual preaching event. But what happens if we turned our churches from doctors' waiting rooms, which is lined up looking at people's heads, to lounge rooms? And during COVID, of course, lounge rooms were featured because we had to pivot, we had to change, and families learnt how to Sabbath well together in their lounge rooms. And some watched online, but some actually learned to do worship in their own way, in their own space. And one of the things that's affecting Australia, and also I found right across the USA, is that churches are finding that families, some have, but not all, have returned to church because they have this understanding now, oh, we can Sabbath better. And sometimes they've weighed church in the balance and found it wanting, which is sad, but they don't find community there, they don't find warmth there, they don't find acceptance there, and they don't feel like their kids are welcomed as equal participants into worship. So there's some challenges there for us if we really want to have a families in our church. And I think that if we don't want families, then we are shooting ourselves in the foot when it comes to being the church. We need all generations. But I think we need to really think about what it means to fuel warm community, what it means to be the church, what it means to welcome everyone as full participants, and what it means to preach in more of an intergenerational manner.
Absolutely. And that's something I'm challenging myself with, is how do I engage everyone in my preaching? And that's a book I do need to read myself. So Dave Sisnos's plenary, what for you overall was the highlights? Because he always presents a lot, and there's a lot of really big content, but what for you are the highlights of his plenary that you would take away and want the audience that are listening to get from what he has to share?
Yes, he said, number one, that when it comes to intergenerational preaching, you don't need to have all the generations present in your congregation for it to be intergenerational. You can still be intergenerational with whoever is there in your audience and preach in an intergenerational way. He based his presentation around the letter from Paul to Colossians, who was praising them to continue in their faith, to grow in their faith and produce fruit, even in the midst of persecution. And we understand that Paul is writing from jail to the Colossian people. He's the persecutor, he's now become the persecuted, and he's encouraging the people to stand firm. And what Dave did at the start was to model what it means to preach in an intergenerational way, in a short way. So we read through this passage, we looked at what stood out for us, what words stood out for us as a collective audience, and took time to talk in twos and threes about that and what stood out for us. And then he said that Paul really wrote encouraging letters to people. Even while in prison, he had the gift of encouraging. And so we had cards on the tables, which he purchased, and stickers and pencils and crayons and things. And we then took the time to actually write a letter to someone we wanted to write an encouraging letter to, and to decorate it with stickers. And yeah, even the youngest, the oldest in the room could do that. Mm. And then they're encouraged to go out and post those letters afterwards. If I was doing this in a church, I'd have stamps ready to go, and we'd stamp them in church, and someone would go on the mailbag and actually mail them out after church. That's how I see it happening. So what he said was, we're all being in the spirit of Paul in being encouragers and writing letters out, just like Paul wrote an encouraging letter to the Colossians. So, so he demonstrated how even a large audience, intergenerational togetherness can work, and also the idea of serving up is an natural intergenerational way to come together and work together. So that was powerful. And then he showed how to do it, and then he went through what intergenerational church looks like, and you need to read the book to get all of that. But basically, he said that we really need to think about a fresh expression of what it means to preach in an intergenerational manner. He said, and one way of preaching is experiencing together, participating together in a shared experience at church. And he talked about other people using creativity, and he mentioned Tammy Preston, who uses creativity in worship. That's what I do when I preach. I often preach with a balloon, and I'm twisting the gospel as I preach, and building a story that even the youngest to the oldest can identify with. So that's one way that I find that I can preach across generations by doing that. Also, I'd encourage church to think of Lego. Lego is a truly intergenerational tool, and they do major sales based on Lego. One of the books I purchased coming over here from a bookstore out of birthday money from my father-in-law was the Lego Story, which I'm reading right now, and how they captured generations through the Lego. So maybe some mixed Lego on tables to help kids and adults work together to build the sermon is a way to bring people together. Play-Doh on the tables, pens, pencils, drawing paper, those sorts of things. Encouraging people to interact and, yes, participate in the sermon. We talked about participation yesterday, are all ways that can happen. And he talked about also some preachers actually bring intergenerational to the preaching event, in that they meet together with generation, with children and others, and get input into what they want to preach about and hear perspectives of the generations into that sermon. So it's part of the sermon prep to get the input. And then the pastor acknowledges the input that he received this week from this person, and the intergenerational thinking informs the sermon and informs the preaching event. So there's various ways that people use to bring the intergenerational factor into the church. He said, be careful with change and to not just say next week all the pews are gone and we're saying do it this way. You've got to sort of nudge in that direction and do it incrementally. Yes. And he gave some four F's, four-letter words. I've got four-letter F words to describe how to change. And this is what he said. Number one is to focus on the point of departure. So where you're departing from what you normally do, make sure you focus on that and what that is, and make sure that you know where you're going. Then he said, find allies. If you're going to make this sort of change, you need to find allies that will help speak what you're doing up and will, basically are already on the page where you're going. So they could be key people in your church and you know who they are, to become allies in helping to make this intergenerational change. He said, bail. We need to gloriously bail. That's another four-letter word, bail. And failure is always an option. And you know where that comes from? A TV show?
Yep.
Yes. David Sinos loves Mythbusters.
I love my Mythbusters too, yep. And I had a mentor who said it was fail forward, but I think fail forward isn't as permissive as to fail gloriously and to accept the fact that we are going to stuff up. What else did he have to say?
And the last F was to fly high. So recognize the moments when it does go well and celebrate those moments as well. And so that they are his F words of change. He said, and this is one that really struck me, we have made the preaching event into something we consume rather than something we participate in. And yesterday we talked about participation and that we don't actually worship unless we're participating. And he said in our consumer culture, it's very easy for everyone to sit back and to listen to the pastor preach and to judge the pastor on his preaching, if you like, have the pastor for dinner. The pastor does the performance. The pastor is the one that opens the Bible. Often the Bibles aren't open in the pews anymore. And, it's become very passive and very consumeristic. So he said that we need to make sure the preaching event is something that we participate in, everyone participates in. Then he said, he finished with what makes a good preacher. He said a good preacher knows themselves, they know the Bible, they know their church, and they nudge people slightly out of their comfort zone. So he said a good preacher has those four factors in their preaching. And then David Sinos quoted a Danish theologian or researcher, and they have done research into preaching, and I'll send you this paper. David sent me the paper after the presentation because I asked him more about it. And this Danish presenter, I can't remember her name, but she says that preaching is not so much the preaching of the word as the preacher preaching. Preaching occurs in the translation and the hearing of that word by the people. And so you haven't preached until the people have heard and interpreted what you are saying. And the preaching is not so much in the telling, but in the what happens in the people when they hear and respond to the preaching. So that sort of takes it from being the talking head to making sure the message is conveyed and the correct message is conveyed as to what you want people to hear.
So what I hear there is, I've got lots of thoughts from that, but for me the biggest one is, if you're the sort of preacher that preaches for an hour, it doesn't mean you've preached.
That's right, you haven't preached.
You can preach in 5 minutes if people have been able to interpret the message and make it interpret it into their hearts and translate it into something that they understand, and it's the correct message. So it's about your clarity of preaching, but also the way in which you get people to engage or participate in that moment.
Yes, so that's where time to maybe get together in groups and discuss what they've just heard. Maybe it's playing it with Play-Doh or Lego or drawing it, or maybe we need to think about if the message is the more important, if the heard message is more important than the preached message, then how do we help the heard message to reach its destination? So that was a bit of a paradigm shift that I experienced today, and that's why I asked David for that paper. And maybe I'll send it to you, Andrew, so you can, if you want, link it as well. So I'm not sure how you do that. Maybe put a PDF somewhere. But yes, it's a very interesting paper and talks about this aspect. After that, I went and hosted a workshop, and I've just got to Dawn Rodman, and she has written a book called Little Feet, Big Faith, I think it's called. Little Feet, Big Faith. I actually purchased it today as a Kindle because it's quite good. She has done her research in child developmental theory, and she was at the University of Oregon when she did a study a number of years ago where all the brain research was coming out of, and she didn't realize it at the time, but Oregon University was where a lot of this pioneering work in brain imaging was coming from. And so she was talking about how babies grow and the neurons that develop in the brain and how it happens in utero, that a baby recognizes mother's voice from the time it's born because it's been listening to its mother's voice and its father's voice. Mm-hmm. And so when the baby's born, it already knows the voice of those parents, and because it hears the muffled voices outside the womb. And I know with your baby coming soon, already would be knowing and listening and responding to your voices.
He responds to our voices, and particularly mum and dad's laugh babies respond to, that sort of research found. But even more than that, as we're discussing at the obstetrician today, he responds to my touch specifically now. So if I touch him with two fingers, he immediately wakes up and starts responding, which is
so he recognises there's something other than Michaela.
Yes.
And so that's really special. But also the implications of that for children and young children, and walking them into the sights, sounds, tastes and smells of the sanctuary. And what is firing in their brain when they see what's happening in worship. And Jesus says, let the children come to me and do not hinder them. And so what does that look like in welcoming children into our sanctuary as full participants and with the brain that grows so much in those first few years? We as a church need to think about the rich sights and tastes and smells and access that occurs. But also, discussed a few times today by Mimi Larson in her presentation and by Rudman in her presentation, and that is often when I go to churches, they place the children and their parents at the back. It's like reserved for parents, probably the last two rows. She says, and both of them say, what does it look like if we welcome children into the center of worship? I know that Kellyville does this very, very well. And also, Mimi Larson showed pictures of churches that removed the first few pews and have put in tables and have put what they call a praise center where children are down the front, in the middle, responding to what's happening. Often they're playing. People think, oh, they've been a distraction, not listening. But actually, when they're asked to respond, they do respond. They are listening as they play and they welcome to the center of worship. And he said, with brain research, he said, if you want to show your child something at the zoo, you don't stand way back at the back, say, oh, look up there, there's a penguin. You take them right to the front. You get the best spot up close and personal to show your child what you're wanting to show them. And he said, she said, what does that happen when we bring it into worship?
So, yeah, do we show them Jesus up close and personal, or do we keep Jesus a bit distant from them? It's a big question.
That's right. And what happens when we dare to assume that children have access to the same tastes, sights, sounds, and smells of worship as we as adults do? And who says that adults own that worship space? They both said also in that you make sure that there are quick exit points where if the baby does get really contentious, the parents can leave the sanctuary with the baby if need be to calm them or to feed them. And I know that Erina Church, one of the things I like your design is that right up there at the stage to the right, there's an exit straight out to the rooms, the children's rooms from the stage. And I think that whoever designed that church was thinking forwardly when it comes to this sort of thing. Imagine the kids down the front, and to be able to escape quickly from the pew if necessary, if there's an accident, whatever else, they're just going to exit stage right, and they're out.
Stage right or left. Right is kids' rooms, left is the toilets, and at the back is two cry rooms or two parents' rooms. But guess what? They're not used for crying babies. Crying babies are allowed in church. Mums generally feel safe to breastfeed in church. It's a very, it's a massive paradigm shift that I as a pastor am having to make internally as well, to change the mindset of, okay, everyone here is accepting of this. How can we run with this and really make this change our culture as well?
Yes, and I think that, as you said, the design is there, and if they're already welcoming babies and into worship like that, then it's not far to look at those sorts of praise centres, I call them, down the front in the middle, where the kids can play and be there with their children. I know that at Kellyville, they have pews that are shortened so that prams can be parked and leave the aisles open as well. So there's those sorts of things that we thought about, and making areas where down near the front where prams can be parked so that children feel welcome. And if his brain science is correct, which I believe it is, and I was able to share with the lecturer some other bits and pieces of brain research around storytelling, what that does to the brain, and especially the young child brain. So many implications for our churches to think about out of today.
Love it. Absolutely love it. That's awesome. And I think there's a lot of implications from some of that research. And I think we as pastors often miss this sort of research. It's stuff that goes by our wayside. So I think maybe something, and maybe it's something to chat with Dr. Steve about as well, Dr. Case, is there a way for us to create, not just from the intergenerational cohort, but a way to create a resource center for pastors, specifically in the Adventist Church, where we can access these sorts of resources and actually learn these sorts of resources and have them readily available in like our MD library, so that we are all processing this sort of information as leaders? Because I think even in Australia, right, with our MD, I think it needs to be a growth area for us as pastors, is how do we do intergenerational ministry in our churches?
Maybe you chat to your uncle and to Russell Wilcox about the idea of adding that in. But also I think you talk to the homiletics lecturers at college about adding intergenerational preaching as a extra idea of the preaching event. I believe that pastors still need to learn how to preach and exposit and use the Bible and deliver that message. But another method that needs to be included there is intergenerational preaching as one of their learning components, to get it into the DNA before pastors graduate and find themselves in churches.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a great summary of all that you learned today. And I know it's late where you are, so I need to let you get to bed, and I need to go and write some sermons, speaking about preaching.
Yes.
But I look forward to catching up with you with tomorrow. What do you have on tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow we finish it just after lunch with the actual Intergenerate conference. But Dr. Steve Case from Andrews University has asked the Adventists, and there's Adventists here from Hong Kong, the whole Hong Kong conference has come, including the children's ministries, the treasurer, the president, they're all here. And we have Adventists from PNG, we have an Adventist from Scotland, and others from the US. So we're all staying on Thursday afternoon and Friday to debrief the conference and look at what are the implications for the Adventist Church. So I'll keep you updated on those as well.
Awesome. Looking forward to it. Well, with that, you better go to bed, and we will catch everyone in the next one.
See you for part 3.